Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. We have an interesting case to tell you about that was handed down by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals last month on November 20th, to be precise, in a case called Voight v. Coyote Creek Mining Company. And this case involves a dispute between a rancher and a coal mine. So if you are in the ranching community or if you are in the energy community, this case could be of interest to you. So I'm going to oversimplify the case a little bit for purposes of laying out the story partly, and partly, Vec, to be perfectly honest, we were not involved in this litigation, so I don't know the granular particularities of this case the way that we often know the clients and so forth when we talk about cases on this show. But I thought this one was interesting enough that we should delve into it anyway. And so what happened here is that Julie Voight is a rancher in North Dakota, and she brought a legal action against a coal mining company that operated a surface coal mine adjacent to her ranch. And what she alleged was that the company had failed to obtain the proper construction permit under the Clean Air Act and failed to implement a dust control plan for the coal processing facility. And if you have ever seen one of these coal processing facilities, I had the when I worked for Congressman Pompeo, he was on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and I had the opportunity to tour one of these. It was a coal electrical plant is the one I toured, which is a little bit different than what we're talking about here. But it's similar in the sense that there's a giant pile of coal outside of the plant that's used in order to generate the electricity. And the advantage that a coal plant has is if there's a blizzard or if there's a flood or if there's if the train tracks are messed up or something like that, you still have the giant pile of coal outside of the plant that's providing fuel to the plant. And it about 3 weeks worth of coal typically is piled up there so that it would allow the facility to outlast any kind of disaster like that. But the problem here, or the accusation at least, is that when the owners of this facility, again the Coyote Creek Mining Company, when they applied for the permit, they applied for the permit essentially where the processing portion of the facility started, and they claimed that the pile of coal that was at the edge of the facility was not actually in the facility. And so under the federal statute, if something's in the facility, then it's considered part of it for purposes of compliance with the Clean Air Act. And if it's not inside the facility, then it's not part of the permit and so forth. And so that was the crux of the dispute here is the pile of coal something that's regulated by the statute, or is it not regulated by the statute? And there's some interesting issues around that. I'm not really going to get into that too much, partly because I'm not sure, Vec, that our audience would be super fascinated by the finer points of the Clean Air Act and what goes into this decision about whether something, you know, is or isn't a part of that particular facility. I will say that much like President Clinton's definition of the word is, depends on what the meaning of the word is. In this case, it depends on what the meaning of the word in is, I-N. So it's these arcane disputes do sometimes come into effect in these regulatory cases.
But the point here is who gets to decide what the word is in is.
That's exactly right. That's the issue here. And so it was a 2-1 decision in favor of the Coyote Creek mine by the Eighth Circuit. And what they decided was that when the plant had applied for its permit and they had gone through the state of North Dakota with a regulatory agency in the state of North Dakota to do that. That agency had issued a permit essentially on the assumption that the pile of coal was not a part of the facility, and the agency in North Dakota was empowered in some ways under federal law. There's they call it a kind of cooperative federalism, that the states have the ability to enforce the Clean Air Act and federal law here. And so this permitting process was done under that process. When the issue came up to the federal court, let me back up one step to say there was not a notice and comment rulemaking process as part of this permit approval. So the Voights did not ever have an opportunity to comment on this facility that was going in right next to their ranch. And so when they brought the lawsuit, that was their first opportunity to really register their concerns and their sort of dueling interpretation of what federal law requires. And you might think that when you're talking about federal law, that the federal courts would be the ones who would be in charge of deciding what federal law means. But two of the three judges on the panel took a different tack, and they said that they would defer to the state agency's interpretation of federal law. Does that surprise you, Vec?
Not only does it surprise me, it's crazy, because the whole point of the courts being there is that they take an oath to the Constitution to interpret the federal law. The states could do anything they wanted, particularly they're not even giving deference to another court. This isn't an idea of comedy. They're saying this unelected agency of a state can interpret federal law. And the mischief that can be created by that, on uniformity, on a whole host of bad results, is amazing to me. I'm glad there was a dissent.
Yes, I am too. I should single out Judge David Strass for praise here in dissenting in this case. And I should mention that my sister knows Judge Strass very well, because he's married to one of her sorority sisters. And so that's how I first met him once upon a time. So it's a small world. But his dissent here is interesting, and he goes right to the point you were just making about uniformity. But he also talks about what are the issues that, you know, whatever you want to say about federal law and U.S. Supreme Court precedent that requires courts to defer to federal agencies' interpretation of federal statutes and federal agency interpretations of federal regulations. And we at the New Civil Liberties Alliance think that there are severe problems with both of those things. The Supreme Court does not require federal courts currently to defer to state agencies' interpretations of federal law. And so one of the things that Judge Strass correctly points out is that there is no precedent to support the majority's what the majority did in this decision. He also points out the uniformity issue, but then he also points out that one of the reasons why it's given sometimes for courts to defer to federal agencies is because Congress gave a delegation to that agency. Sometimes it's an actual delegation. Sometimes it's sort of a presumed or implicit delegation to the agency because there's expertise there. And the question whether there is a sort of double delegation then down to a state agency, or whether that same expertise exists, because Vec, even though the federal agency may have written the regulation, this state agency did not write the regulation. It was not involved in the writing of the regulation.
Not only did not write it, but when I'm a congressman and I'm ruling on the law, all my advisors and the legal advisors are telling me what federal law and what federal courts will do. The people who advise you don't tell you anything about state agencies and what they might do when you're deciding to vote on a law.
That's a good point. So you don't, I think there's two things that come out of that. One is I don't think that Congress is intending to delegate this sort of authority to state agencies in terms of interpreting federal law. And then there isn't the same expertise about the drafter's intent and that kind of thing. Even if you buy that argument for a federal agency, it just doesn't exist when you're talking about a state agency, because again, they didn't write the statute, so they didn't write the regulations, so they're not in any better position to interpret it than the federal courts. But the other problem that I would argue exists with this way of doing things is it's not clear to me that the Voights really get a fair trial here when two of the three judges they're appealing to are deferring to one side of the V. If they're taking the legal interpretation of Coyote Creek, not because they think Coyote Creek has a better interpretation of the statute than the Voights have, but they're doing it because the government has weighed in on that side and they're deferring to that interpretation. That just doesn't necessarily feel like due process to me, or feel like a fair, not what we would expect a federal trial to look like, Vic.
Exactly. It's like putting your thumb on the scale. And this whole thing, Judge Strauss is in dissent. But given the topic, I think of the country song, "I'm just a lump of coal now, Lord, but I'll be a diamond someday." And hopefully Strauss's opinion will be the diamond down the road, because this, we challenge deference theories all the time at NCLA. And now another one's just popped up. It's like they're multiplying.
Yeah, it's like the multi-headed hydra or something like that. The only quibble that I'll have with Judge Strauss about this is that he calls it Voight deference. And this is something that judges do all the time. I think they pick the shortest name in the caption or something when they want to denote something. But the Voights didn't get the deference here. Coyote Creek got the deference here. And so if you're going to have a new kind of deference, it should be called Coyote Creek deference, not Voight deference. It's adding insult to injury to name the deference after the person who didn't get it.
Or just but that's, as they're notoriously sneaky.
that would be appropriate. And again, I don't pretend to have expertise on the underlying statutory issue here. It could well be that Coyote Creek is right about its interpretation of federal law, but that's not relevant to this deference issue. The court should be deciding this on its own. It shouldn't be deferring to the state agency in making the decision. Have you heard the word? The revolution's over. That's the Kinks with our lead-in music there. And I don't know that the revolution is over. But Vec, it certainly feels like there are some unusual things that have happened in 2020 that have deformed the law in serious ways. And one of them we've already talked a little bit about on this program is the nationwide eviction moratorium that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put into place back in September. And there've been a number and we've talked about that. I don't want to necessarily go back into exactly what the genesis of that order was and what it does, other than to say that for our listeners who didn't hear us the first time, that this eviction moratorium prevents anyone from being evicted from their housing if they meet certain criteria, including that they make under $100,000 a year, for example. There have been a number of stories now, because this eviction moratorium is set to expire on December 31st. There have been a number of stories about, well, what's going to happen to folks once this expires? And so I thought we might spend this last segment talking a little bit about the issue, and if there are ways to address this problem that don't involve violating the civil liberties of NCLA's clients, but really landlords across the country. Because what the order did is it prevented any of the landlords from going to landlord-tenant court. In fact, it made it a federal crime with a $100,000 fine, up to a year in prison, if anyone tries to evict a tenant when this moratorium is in effect. And so I've been racking my brain trying to think. I've been a lawyer for 20 years now. I can't think of a time when I've ever seen a law that made it a crime to try to use the court process to solve a legal dispute. It's just a bizarre thing.
Not only that, but it's issued by the CDC, right? The Center for Disease Control. If I'm a landlord or I'm a tenant, not in my wildest dreams would I think that my agreement on either side could suddenly be nullified and controlled by the Center of Disease Control. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. The president didn't do it. The Congress didn't have to do it. Some bureaucracy says, I am the czar of all things because there's a disease. And then they say, you, landlord, cannot go to court if someone's not paying you. And there's another thing, Mark. You said that, you know, if they're under $100,000, but all the tenant has to do is put in a piece of paper saying these things. It's almost impossible to test whether they're true or not because you're skating on thin ice when you go in and say, hey, look, Mike, they're lying. Well, are you going to get fined because you went in to the court? The fact is that even though they've put in these so-called limits on it, they're not real limits because there's no way to get to court to test it. And courts have just been throwing, oh, no, they put in the affidavit the CDC says you need. So that's it. You're out of luck, landlord. And these people could go bankrupt. They could go absolutely bankrupt because they got to pay water. They got to pay electricity. They got to pay everything a landlord pays. But they're
not getting money out of it. They got to pay the mortgage, John.
Yes. All
right. I mean, that's the biggest deal. We have a number of clients who this is how they make ends meet. Right. They have four or five properties. They take the money in for those properties. They charge a little more in rent than they owe in the mortgage. And that's how they put food on their table. But if you have four or five properties and one or two of your tenants are not paying you any rent at all, you're quickly not making money. And in fact, losing money on a monthly basis.
And all your tenants find out, and then they all put in the affidavit, and then you're not making any money. And the outrage of this, Mark, is that the CDC does not affect the banks. So the bank who holds the mortgage can take the property from the landlord, maybe their life savings in it, and they are allowed to evict the tenant, the banks.
I
cannot tell you how unfair that is. And I do not think anything like this would ever get through Congress.
Never.
It's why administrative agencies that aren't responsible to anyone and don't have to listen to people complain because there's no avenue for it are such a danger to your property rights and all of your rights.
Oh, this is a quintessential example of administrative law run amok. And Vec, I think one of the problems here, one of the reasons why this is such a bad moratorium and such a badly written order is it's not just that the CDC has no expertise in housing law, which you are absolutely right to point out. And some of the really ridiculous, crazy aspects of this have to do with the fact that the CDC has no expertise in housing law. And actually, let me go on a quick tangent to say that the CDC does have some power over housing. So if, for example, your next door neighbor were to have tuberculosis or have some sort of communicable disease like that, and or maybe that you live next to some kind of a food distribution facility that was infested with rats or something like that, the CDC can come in and they can clean up those diseased or infested areas, or they can put a quarantine on those sorts of things. But to actually force a landlord to keep a healthy person in a healthy habitat does not seem to be within the CDC's purview under existing federal law. At least that's how I read it. But anyway, what I was starting to say is it's not just a question of them not having housing law expertise. They also, because they don't have the statutory authority, right? Congress didn't give the CDC the power to do this. They're trying to invent the power. They're trying to read into a statute that does govern them to create this power. And so it really limits them on what they can do. They can't come up with a nuanced solution because a nuanced solution would depend on actually having real power from Congress. And they don't. So they end up using this blunt instrument in order to try to achieve the goal that they want to achieve. And that's why I think you're absolutely right. Congress never would have approved this kind of a solution. In fact, Congress didn't approve this kind of solution in the CARES Act last year, and I think we did go into this last time we talked about it, but there was a temporary eviction moratorium that Congress passed last spring, but it expired on July 31st. And the very fact that it expired on July 31st and Congress had made it temporary tells you that there wasn't power in the federal agency to do this before that statute passed.
You would think that it does, but I have to say And there's another problem. There's obviously the states have done it. I think we should point out that the CDC order by its terms only applies to places where the states don't have a similar or stronger moratorium in place. But, you know, all these states and Congress have the power of the purse. They have the power of taxation. If they thought this was a good idea, then everybody should pay for it. You can't take an unpopular part of the population and make them suffer all of the burdens of public policy. It's not how it's supposed to work. And this particular CDC order that is a criminal penalty, that wasn't a criminal penalty yesterday because a bureaucratic agency wants to cut off your going to court. That is the crime, to go to court. Well, that leads to incentives for violence. It leads to incentives for bad behavior. The whole reason we have courts is so people don't get in fistfights on the streets. And this is, it's just outrageous.
I think that's a very good point. And that's why I think that the CDC order violates the Constitution, right? It violates the Fifth and the 14th Amendments. It's denying due process of law and access to the courts to these property owners. And that's not the Constitution doesn't permit that kind of interference. And as you say, that's why the courts exist in the first place. But the other thing that the CDC has done here is it's put out these frequently asked questions, these FAQs, because the order was hopelessly imprecise in some of the things it was doing. And so now you have this guidance out there, these FAQs, and it doesn't have the force of law. Guidance does not have the force of law. It hasn't gone through Congress. It hasn't even gone through a notice and comment rulemaking process. And so you just have an agency who doesn't know what it's doing, issuing guidance, trying to sort of solve the problem on the fly, if you will. And you're absolutely right that the legislative power, either at the state level or at the federal level, needs to get involved here. I have tremendous sympathy. When this expires on December 31st, and there are folks who could be put out in the cold in the middle of winter, that is an evil thing. It is not a good thing for folks to be homeless or to not have access to shelter. And I am 100% in favor of both private and public solutions to that situation. What I'm not in favor of is solutions that involve violating the civil rights of someone else, because that's not how the Constitution works. As you said, Vec, we need to find solutions to this kind of problem that don't violate other people's rights.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I agree with you on that. And the thing is, that's another problem with these administrative. We don't know. Nobody right now, I get calls from clients all the time, neither you nor I, who follow this issue, have any idea what's happening on December 31st. We have no idea.
Right.
They just put something out or not put it out. It is not law. It is whim.
That's right. That's right. And look, the other thing is, I think this is potentially problematic in the long term for tenants, right? Because the order creates this uncertainty that you're talking about. And so landlords in the future are going to have to raise rents, partly to make up for the losses incurred from the moratorium, but also to insure against the possibility of future moratoria, which they never were doing before because they never thought this was a possibility. They're going to have to demand higher security deposits. They're going to be less willing to rent to people whose income is uncertain. All of these sorts of effects are going to decrease the supply of housing available to tenants that are in this socioeconomic situation right now. And that's bad for them in the long run.
They're going to require guarantees from other people who have more much. So you're going to have people on the hook. You know, kids aren't going to be, young people aren't going to be able to go and get an apartment. They're going to have their parents sign or something. It creates an enormous incentives not to let people just go rent apartments, but instead have to have all these various bells and whistles because you don't want this ever happen to you again. Because it's traumatizing. If this is your retirement and you're going to kick that, you're going to have to lose your house to the bank because somebody else isn't paying the mortgage. Believe me, those people are
going to
take steps.
Oh, what a tangled web the administrative state weaves. Thank you for joining us on Administrative Static. We'll see you next week.